tuned for The Lin Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with director Jesse Zhao. Jesse is here in Sarasota for the second time to direct the play The Drunken City for the students at the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training. So many of the people I interview discovered their passion, the career they eventually entered, very early in life. This isn't really true for Jesse. Jesse discovered his passion for creativity, for storytelling, for make-believe. And then, in high school, having been in his first play, he discovered what he calls a strange isolated me, finding the other strange isolated kids who had found themselves. This was the beginning of what would turn out to be a career for him. But it was some time in the making, even still. It's a really interesting story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lin Show. The Lin Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you would like to be. Not the person who, if you were it, you expect that people would like you better, admire you, hire you, pay attention to you, love you, pay you. No. Not the person someone else told you you had to be or should be. Not the person other people are, but the person that you really are. I know it's ironic, but nonetheless true. So many of us are acting as if the person we're presenting is who we really are, when in fact we have been hiding parts of ourselves. Did somebody tell you when you were a child that you laughed too loud, or you shouldn't cry, or you shouldn't get angry, or your interest in reading was a bad thing, or your interest in drawing or dancing, or something that you liked or did, some behavior, some interest was not all right? We can hear this in our family of origin. We can hear this in school. We can hear this from our religious organizations or from cultural organizations. We can hear this from lots of places. And the end result of that is that so many of us, as I said, come into adulthood pretending that some things that are true of us are not. But as a therapist, it's clear to me that life is better lived if you are the person you really are, not spending any energy in denial or pretense. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in this interview with Jesse, you not only hear who he really is. He is a director. He makes his life and his living from the directing of plays. But it took Jesse a while to uncover this desire, this passion, this need, really. And listening to how Jesse did it, how he honored himself at every step, so that when he finally made the choice to pursue a career in directing, it was the very best and correct choice for him. This is truly an interesting story. I'm going to stop talking and let Jesse tell it. So here now is Jesse Zhao. Okay, I'm here with Jesse Zhao. And I'm interviewing Jesse because he is directing the production of Drunken City for the Oslo Conservatory.
Correct.
And I'm explaining to Jesse that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And so it seems clear that the art to which you are giving your life is the art of directing?
Yes, correct.
Yes, okay. That's a niche, directing.
Yes.
Right. Okay, good. So I only ask one question, and it is, can you remember the very first time in your life when anything that looked like directing got your attention? Telling people what to do, telling stories, moving things around, any of that?
I, very vaguely, you know, I don't think there was a single thing that kind of turned me on to directing, because I was always very, you know, I was always very interested in creativity as a child, and...
Wait. Okay, so, when you say you were interested in creativity as a child, could you be more explicit?
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely. I loved to draw. I would create, like, fanciful narratives inside of the drawings that I was making. I had this whole science fiction world going on in my brain when I was a kid that I was putting down on paper. Probably made no sense to anyone but myself, but I was very much interested in storytelling.
And how old were you when you were doing that?
I think probably about 6, 7 years old is the
Spartak,
you know.
Did they read to you? Did you see movies? I mean, did this just come to you by yourself? Or
I think I loved reading on my own, you know.
Like, at 6?
Well, I mean...
Right.
You know, I was sort of discovering that. But I think as I was getting older, I I've always been a little bit of an introvert, so books were a great escape for me in terms of, you know, and I just remember, like, being in, I mean, I don't remember how the timings of all this works out, but I just remember being in the third grade and really kind of discovering the library for the first time and, you know, really like, oh, I would...
Wow.
Constantly, yeah, exactly, be reading strange little books for kids and that sort of thing, and... So
essentially what I hear you saying is that stories captured you very young.
Yes, exactly.
And did they read to you? Do you know if that comes... It just, you found a story somehow and fell in love?
I think they didn't read to me specifically, I think, but I think I just sort of fell into reading and, you know, again, because I didn't like talking to people, you know, and I didn't like social situations, it was just a good way of escaping, you know?
Yeah, no, I got it. What the only piece that's missing here is how you found stories. I mean, because lots of kids who didn't want to talk to anybody might have, I don't know, played with blocks, hid in their room and talked to themselves. Right. I don't know, but you found stories.
But even inside, I think for me, even inside of that sense of play, even inside the blocks, even inside of playing with action figures, even inside of the drawings that I was doing, you know, it was all sort of, there was sort of a storytelling element. I was telling myself a story.
Yeah, you were making up a life.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, in that life, and of course, you know, I feel as if all human beings do this, so I don't feel unique in that sense. But for me, that was very important. And
Well, and actually, I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah.
I think all human beings are capable of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure all human beings do it. I think you were very lucky.
Mm.
Well, maybe there's another way to describe it beside luck, but you found something that really worked for you, that mm-hmm. really filled the time in a productive and intriguing and not dangerous way. you know, I'm serious,
yes,
you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, all right. So you're making stories out of everything.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you use that in your childhood? Or, I mean...
Well, you know, you don't, you know, like, I think I had a strong sense of make-believe. I think, you know, I could certainly entertain myself for hours doing things. And, and I think, you know, as I sort of got older, actually third grade, I discovered the library. Fourth grade, I think, was the first time I was sort of put in the position of saying, oh, I have a possibility of performing in a show.
Oh.
And so, yeah,
tell me.
And so we were, I think it was a class, it was just, you know, actually it was a sad thing because it was a failed project because my fourth grade teacher wanted to put on a school play and she had chosen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as an adaptation of that as the class project. And unfortunately, she got the rights, she got the costume, she worked very hard to make all that happen. But at the end of the day, the school wouldn't permit it. So we ended up just performing it in class.
Why wouldn't the school permit it?
I don't know. I think it was bureaucracy. I think she didn't go through the right channels. Like, I don't know the whole story behind
my.
It. I just know that, you know, there was, you know, she had gotten all the stuff and it was all in the classroom ready to be taken on the stage and she was very excited about it and then it was just like it couldn't be performed.
Wow.
But we ended up just performing it in class. And so I think that was, you know, I think that was the first.
Did you audition or did she just assign roles? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I do remember being disappointed with my casting because.
What were you?
I was a robin. I had one line. I flew through. And
you flew through?
Yes, I flew through. I just kind of said my line, went away. And, you know, I mean, when you're fourth grade or whatever, you know, it's, I think you don't really kind of appreciate the opportunity itself. You appreciate what you were denied, you know. And so
I think that goes right on into adulthood, my dear.
Maybe so. And
but you're saying that you really, you liked it or you were drawn to it or you saw possibilities?
Well, I saw possibility in it. And then I think as I got older, the storytelling kept, you know, I was doing theater in high school.
Oh, stop.
Sure.
Was there a drama class?
In high school?
Yeah.
Yes, there was.
And so, are you saying that you were in it?
I spent the first, because I'm a naturally introverted person,
mm-hmm.
right, I spent the first two years of high school just kind of hiding, you know, and then I think it was in my junior year that I auditioned for the school play. We did Grease. I played Eugene, the school nerd. So,
well, how did that feel?
That was lovely. I mean, that was a really kind of eye-opening experience. It was sort of, you know, finding one's people for the first time, you know,
yes.
And feeling like, you know, here's strange me, and here's strange isolated me, and here are the rest of the strange isolated kids who have found their way together. And so that was a really eye-opening and transformative experience for me. And from there, you know, I became interested in acting, and I have this very clear memory of, you know, once I had started doing theater in high school, my sister, who was in high school at the same time but at a different school, she had to do a class video project where I think they decided to do some sort of Shakespearean murder mystery or something. I think they took, like, the Scottish play, which the name we don't say in theaters. But and they were going to do some sort of video project about it. And I just remember watching her and her friends work on this project and finally coming over and starting giving them direction, telling them, you know, you need to do this, or, you know, this moment here is this, or whatever. And I think that was the first time that suddenly the directing thing sort of popped up.
Turned on.
Yeah, I mean, they completely ignored me. They just
said, I mean, that was going to end. Right? They did? Yeah. They ignored you?
They ignored me because it was like, it was their project and I had like no relationship to anyone she was working with. So, but just the moment of my feeling like I could venture, oh, that moment, you know.
So it was a recognition for you that you knew something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, or at least I had an intuition for something.
Yeah,
you know?
You thought you knew it. It didn't, you know, whether you did or not.
Exactly.
But you, right. Yeah.
Exactly. That.
Yeah. And okay, but you, what? How old were you there? You said.
Oh, that well, started theater in high school, so about 16, I think. So actually, I'm wrong. The video project story actually was when I was like 15. So I think even then I was sort of feeling.
The
stirrings of it.
You certainly knew that there was a career as an actor. Did you know there was such a thing as a director?
I didn't. Or I didn't understand what it was, you know. And then actually when, so I'm going to skip ahead a few more years, to when I went to New York, because I had an opportunity to go to New York with a job, with a survival job, which was going to pay, you know, my bills.
Okay, wait. Because you skipped something.
Yes.
So at any point in from 15 on...
Yes.
Did you say to yourself, I want to be an actor, I want to be in theater, I want to do some of that?
I knew that I wanted to be in theater.
So you didn't define it?
Didn't define it. I thought, and I think that a lot of young people have this impression that theater means acting.
Yes, you know? That's what, right. So you thought that perhaps, or that was where the road, right?
Right, that if I wanted to be in the theater, that I'd have to follow the path of an actor.
Yeah,
didn't understand the other, I mean, I knew that these other jobs existed, but I didn't quite understand, you know, their significance.
Well, and also you weren't having any help.
Yeah.
Nobody was telling you, right?
No.
Okay.
Well, yeah, no.
So did you go to college?
I did go to college. I went to Rice University in Houston, Texas, which does not have a theater major.
And that was my next question.
Yes.
So what did...
No, so I was a psychology major. Actually, I was a recovering pre-med student because, you know, like all nice Chinese boys, my parents wanted me to be a doctor. So I did the good son thing, and I did 2 years of science in university. And it was actually the second week of my junior year, and I was in biochemistry, and I thought to myself, I don't like this.
Yeah.
Which is when I was going to double major in biology and psychology, I think, at that point. But then at that point...
Yeah, you were going to be some kind of doctor.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. And so...
So while you knew what you wanted,
mm-hmm.
you were also busy being a good boy.
Yes.
So you couldn't, right?
Yes.
So at that moment in biochemistry, did you say to yourself, been there, done that, can't do this, and sorry, Mom and Dad?
It wasn't so much sorry, Mom and Dad, so much as... I know I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I think, not my path, you know.
So what did you do?
So I focused on psychology, and I still did the theater in university.
Because they didn't have a program.
They had extracurricular, you know, program, you know.
So was
student
there,
groups produce theater.
Oh, student
know,
groups.
Exactly, and that sort of thing. And so actually Rice University has, well, at the time I was a student there, they have a formal program now, but when I was a student there, a lot of the theatrical activity was student-driven, and it was they were very productive, you know, so...
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
A school that has no drama department has a lot of students who are...
Yeah.
That's really, I don't know, odd, no?
Well, they had a director of theater, and he sort of led the main student group, and so they were very active. But yeah, in terms of having a formal program of study, no. You know, there were classes, but, you know, there was no sort of formal...
Oh, there were classes. There were drama classes.
There were drama classes,
Did you
yes.
take them?
I think I made two of them, you know. And again, I was really kind of in that weird headspace of, like, not knowing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I got the most out of those classes that I could have, but...
No, but what's kind of interesting to me is, the path, right?
Yes.
So you still have not said... This is what I am. This is what I do. You're still straddling.
Right. Right. The most I thought it would be just an avocation as opposed to a vocation.
Yes. You know I'd like to have this in my life.
Exactly.
But, right. Okay,
exactly.
Good. So you graduate with some kind of BA in psych?
Yes. Graduated with BA in psych. At Rice University is right across from the Texas Medical Center in Houston. And so I went from Rice to working for the chairman of medicine at Baylor College of Medicine as a medical editor. And so I was doing that work for him for a few years. And that, again, I was paying my bills. I was...
You're a good boy.
I was being a good boy, yes, exactly. I was you know, again, doing community theater, that sort of thing.
And thinking that this might be your life, that you have a straight
exactly.
job that pays really well, and then you have your hobby.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so the man I was working for at Baylor came up to, was appointed to the deanship at Cornell Medical College in New York. And so he said, do you want to come with me? Because I'm going to need someone to help me there, too.
So this is how you get to New York.
So this is how I got to New York. Yes, exactly. So it's a totally good boy path, right?
Yeah.
And so I get up there, and I spend actually the first few years in New York just focusing really doing on this medical writing, medical editing thing that I'm doing before I finally work up the nerve to, like, sign up for an acting class there in New York. And
wow.
So it's there that I sort of, again, rediscover my people, the strange, isolated people who find their way into theater classes.
Right.
And so I did that for about 10 years before I finally said, you know what, I need to get, if this is what I want to do with my life, I have to get serious. You know?
Okay, wait. This is really interesting. So 10 years, you're what, 30?
Yes.
And you say, well, I really want this.
I really want to do
so something. I have to take the risk?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what do you do?
So
you know this is not a normal. This is not,
this
well,
is
not normal.
Well,
it's
this
just
is,
not.
This is not the usual path.
It's not traditional, right?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
And so, I said, you know, I've been doing theater sort of recreationally, sort of avocationally for the last few years. Nothing. It's not an impressive resume. There's not a lot happening. You know, I'm not doing like things at the major theaters or anything like that, right? But you know, there's a few things. And so I decide, okay, well, I'm going to apply to graduate schools. You know,
yes,
with my thin resume, which, you know.
But you keep getting cast. You don't have an impressive resume, but you keep getting cast.
Well, actually, no, I'm sorry, I skipped over something, actually, because at this point, after a few years in New York, and taking a few acting classes and thinking that was the way into theater if I wanted to do it, I realized I didn't like acting anymore.
Oh.
I realized I didn't have anything. I realized, for me, I didn't have a reason to be acting. You know, it wasn't.
So while the people felt good, and
yes.
the thing didn't turn you on.
Yes. So the community, you know, the community was exciting to me. But again, the thing of doing acting was not interesting to me. So that was at that point that I started thinking, well, okay, what else could I do in the theater? Which is
so I can stay with my people.
Exactly. It was just when I started to think more seriously about directing. And so that's where I had. So at that point, when I made the decision to start applying to graduate schools, I was already sort of committing myself to the idea that I was going to be a director because
right.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And I realized for me, and again, this ties into my psychology background, because if I hadn't become a director, I think I would have become a therapist.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say these things are not dissimilar.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And the therapy, the psychology really helps, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
100%. And so, I found that, again, you know, the thing that was, the acting wasn't interesting to me, but again, going back to the original impulse, which was stories, figuring out the stories was, you know. And so, you know, understanding what was happening between two characters was suddenly very interesting to me, and being able to talk to people about that, you know.
This is clear, but I mean, and it flips right back to telling your sister and her friends.
Yes, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That initial
that was always what felt right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, being able to observe and say, this is what I'm seeing, and this is what I think is happening.
Right.
Again, a great skill for a therapist.
Yeah. it's not too late, you know? I mean,
I know,
you're
exactly.
You're going to get tired of this,
yes,
right?
Exactly. No, I'm already starting to plan. So, so I get to this point then in 2006, I think, which I decide, okay, I've been moving towards directing. Again, my resume is not impressive. I've not been doing the things that other people with more serious commitment to directing have been doing, you know? But here I am. So I'm going to apply. So I applied to a few schools, and really just by sheer great fortune, I was accepted to the Yale School of Drama.
Oh!
Yeah, which, and I think the main reason I was accepted, and I wasn't accepted because I had a really stunning resume. I think they accepted me because they took a chance on my potential.
Yeah.
And because the way that I was in... The process at Yale is you have an interview, and then they bring you back to do a director's callback, where they give you 30 minutes and a scene, and they watch you work with actors.
Ooh.
And so I think it was watching me work with actors, and again applying those
intuition. All the things you'd been studying.
Yes, yes, all right. The sort of intuition that I have for things, all the things that I've been studying, and they said, you know, he has actually a really great sense of text, and you know, working with actors, and so they took a shot at me for that reason. That's my feeling. They've never told me this directly, but that was my feeling. And
I'm wondering if also it didn't hurt that you were an older student.
It's interesting, actually, because I think, you know, at least at Yale, my experience, my observation had been in terms of the classes surrounding me that they generally were sort of looking for people in their mid to late 20s, you know. So I was on the older side, you know, and when I was a student there, I was sort of one of the older students in my class. So I don't know if it helped me or not, but I think it did. I don't think I would have been ready to do it, you know.
No, clearly not.
No,
clearly not. Yeah. You were still straddling.
Exactly, I was still straddling.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You had to fall on the side, right, before you could.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you had presented yourself earlier, they'd have felt that.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, I think so. I believe that 100%.
Yeah. And also, I want to say with this older thing, it speaks well of them that they took a chance on an older student, right? They must have felt not only that you had potential, but that you were committed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, otherwise, why would they
take
a slap from somebody, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so they accept you at Yale.
Yes.
And what happens?
For me, it was three of the most incredible years of my life.
Yay.
Really, because I loved my faculty. I loved my classmates.
Well, you did actually find your place now.
I felt that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt that. I felt that I had found the thing that I could do to make the art that I wanted to make. And it was really challenging because I think initially, you know, I mean, as you know, I mean, so many of us really kind of suffer with imposter syndrome, right? We feel like we don't belong, you know, even though we've been accepted.
Yes, right. Never mind. Right. You made a mistake.
Exactly.
Right? And you'll
exactly.
discover it soon.
Exactly. And I think for my first couple of months in graduate school, I felt very much sort of behind the eight ball because my path to getting there had been so different from, you know,
right.
because...
I need to ask this. Were there very many Chinese people in your... In your
there were there were a few not Chinese, but there were a few there were other Asian students.
There were.
Yeah. And so so I didn't feel isolated in that sense,
okay.
You know, and my time at Yale was very diverse. So I think that
good for Yale.
Yeah. And you know, they continue to make that commitment, and so I think that especially growing up in Houston, Texas in a really you know, predominantly white neighborhood,
yeah.
you know, like that was like I was, yeah. like
Well,
that.
No wonder you felt, oh my goodness.
Yeah, so right. I felt a lot of that, you know.
Well, it's interesting because you, in some way, your whole life set you up to feel sort of not a part of.
Mm.
The place you were born into, the place you lived, your shyness or introversion,
yeah.
you know, your interest in things that most of the kids your age were not interested in. I mean, really,
right.
you know.
Right.
So maybe it's... Not surprising that it took you so long, and it's actually quite wonderful that you found a place where you knew that you belonged.
Yeah, exactly. And so my time at Yale was very, very, it was wonderful. It was, you know, I have a little...
And were you a directing major? Is that...
Yeah,
they have
directing, they have a Master of Fine Arts in directing, and so that was my track, you know, and so, you know, over the course of 3 years, I worked very hard. They worked me very hard. They challenged me. And it was actually a really lovely moment because I think, again, because I started the whole process with a lot of imposter syndrome, you know, because, again, feeling I was behind everyone else because I hadn't been doing it. You know, I didn't know anyone. I didn't, you know, I wasn't as savvy about the industry as other people were. And I spent the first couple of months feeling the sort of pressure of graduate school and thinking, okay, I have to be something different, you know.
Oh, yes.
And thinking that, you know, well, I have to become more provocative. I have to be an edgier director. I have to, you know, whatever, you know, I have to mirror some sort of image of an auteur that, you know, that I had in my brain. And it was actually a really kind of freeing moment in graduate school, actually, which happened for me close to the end of the experience, when I realized that all this time that my faculty and all these people that had been talking to me and trying to train me, they had not been trying to change me.
No.
They had,
quite the opposite.
Exactly. They had just wanted me to
find yourself.
Find myself, exactly.
Yeah.
Find my own voice, you know, and be more of who I was, only with new skills.
Right.
You know, I didn't have to be a director that I thought I had to be.
You know? What you imagined a director was.
Exactly what I imagined a director was. I could be the person. That was a really powerful and freeing moment.
Do you know how that happened? I mean, because that is really, that's actually the whole theme of the Lynn Show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that that too many of us come out of childhood in denial for aspects of ourselves for reasons that are different but are the same.
Yeah.
And that that life is better lived if you are who you really are. So do you remember? I mean, it's clear that you remember the experience, the
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any memory of how it happened, if somebody said something to you, or it was just an inside epiphany?
I think it was an inside epiphany. I think it was happening while I was writing my thesis.
Really?
Yes, because my thesis, the written thesis at Yale is a sort of processing of your thesis production. So,
what was your thesis production?
An Arthur Schnitzler play called La Ronde, which is basically 10 scenes of people meeting and hooking up. And it's a play from the 19th century
mm-hmm.
Vienna. So, you know, so it's
so it was risque.
It was risque at the time, exactly. But it was it was definitely a challenging project for me.
Why did you choose that? Do you know?
It was not my first choice, but it was the choice that I think that everyone thought was the right one for me. So I was like, okay, so I'll try it. And there was something about, and actually, you know, the interesting experience of La Ronde was that, you know, I started off having really ambivalent feelings about the play itself, but I ended up loving Schnitzler, because the more I learned about him, the more fascinated I was by him, and I realized, you know, like, there's a lot going on, and it really felt, and I think for me, my thesis production really gave me a chance to kind of connect deeply with him, you know, and it was nice to sort of reach back in time and find someone who was sort of like struggling with some of the same issues I was struggling
with.
Well,
I was just going to ask that question.
Know.
Do you mind saying anything about what the kinship you felt to him?
Yeah. Schnitzler came from a middle-class background, and so he came from a great deal of respectability, but in many ways, he was very obsessed with his experience of the world. You know, he was a very sexual creature, and he liked to sort of, you know, document his.
Right. That's what La Ronde is, right?
Exactly.
A little sexier, a little sexier.
Exactly.
Right.
So, in sort of thinking, and so because he was sort of coming up in that sort of modernist era, you know, and Freud was a contemporary of his, and all that sort of thing. They're all sort of obsessed with the interior life,
yes.
You know, and so, so I really kind of connected him.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting because, of course, your introversion.
Yes.
Is the same thing.
Yes.
And your stories, this is all interior life, right?
Exactly.
It's great.
Exactly.
It's great. And so we have the synchronicity of you finding Schnitzler, right?
Yes, exactly.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether I liked
it or
not.
Whether
you choose
it or not,
right? But he became a writer that I greatly loved, you know, and so I was really kind of fascinated. I mean, he's got some beautiful writing that
we're not talking just about plays?
Not just about plays, no. He has a novel called, I think it's called Dream Novel or something like that, but it's the book that Eyes Wide Shut, that movie by Stanley Kubrick, was based on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really strange and haunting and beautiful, and like, you know, and for as much as La Ronde is kind of this frothy sex comedy or whatever, you know, Dream Novel is this really kind of potent and like kind of terrifying view of like the other side of like, you know, repression and hidden desire.
This is so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because you present, of course, like the good Chinese boy you were.
Thanks.
Right?
Thank you.
And but clearly, you have this other thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And I really want to hear the rest of the story, but I want to interject that you directed How I Learned to Drive.
Yes, I did.
Which is a pretty dark piece.
It is. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
A pretty dark sexual piece.
Yes.
Right? Which made me very uncomfortable, I want to tell you.
Sure.
You know? So clearly, I mean, I don't know how that happened,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to know. But clearly there's that. And now you're directing Drunken City, which I understand is not a dark. Oh, is it?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because we started, you know, I started.
Oh, wait, no. We'll get there.
Right, right,
okay. All right, good. So what's interesting to me is that you don't present as somebody who is interested in that. And that, I think, is the dichotomy of the way you were raised and what you were told you were supposed to be and who you really were.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right, and that you found a way to meld them
is
really lovely. Really lovely.
Well, you know, it's not perfect. I'm still, you know, I struggle every day with it, but...
But you know what the struggle is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, and that's
You're not in denial for it.
No.
And that's all that we can ask for,
right,
I think.
Right,
really.
Try not to be in denial you know, and just sort of remind
Well, even
myself.
If you just express it in your work.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Right. That you get it.
Exactly.
That you get to get it. Right. Okay, good. Okay, so in the discovery of Schnitzler, you also are given permission to be Jesse. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it was in sort of processing the experience of working on that play and writing about it and think, you know, I sort of realized, had that moment of thinking, okay, they didn't need me to be a different director. They needed me to figure out who I was.
Yeah. Wow, it's amazing that you made that leap. But good. Congratulations. So what happens?
So from there, I think that sort of opened they gave me sort of a release, you know, of that burden, and so I sort of started working from that point of view, and then I graduated from my master's program, and then had to figure out how does one
now what now
yeah exactly what now how does one because again you know going into graduate school I hadn't you know I'll just give this as background because I think it's important because for my observation you know people. Young directors who are sort of committed to doing it really kind of start in their 20s. And there's a certain, at least in the United States, there's a certain sort of circuit that they kind of go through.
Well, and they start meeting people,
exactly.
And they build relationships.
Exactly.
And that, right.
Exactly. And that was something that I didn't have
because
I was doing medical editing for 10 years,
right.
You know. So I kind of went in and I just had nothing to sort of fall back on. For I had the people that I knew from Yale, you know, and that was a great group and very supportive.
The other thing that occurs to me, and maybe I'm wrong about this, is that when you went to graduate school, you weren't thinking any further than graduate school.
That's right.
I'll do this now.
Exactly. I know that's really true. I'll own that because I think for me it was just like I need to figure out if I'm an artist.
Right. Right. You know? And then I'll think about what.
Exactly.
Right,
and then I'll think about. Or I thought, you know, and maybe this is just laziness, but I was just sort of like thinking, the path will reveal itself as I continue, you know?
Well, maybe it did. So let's see.
Exactly. Exactly. So I graduated, was sort of, you know, not sure what to do. Some really wonderful opportunities came my way in terms of getting to go on tour for a year with a theater company called the Acting Company, which was founded by John Houseman and Margot.
How did that happen?
Basically, they were looking for someone to basically maintain their shows on the road. And James Bundy, who's the dean at Yale, had said, you know, contact Jesse.
Oh,
interview
very
Jesse.
Nice.
And so they interviewed. We hit it off. I went on the road with them for a year, which was a great experience, just being able to travel all across the United States.
It didn't look bad on your resume either.
It doesn't look bad on the resume either. No, not at all. But for me, it was more about the opportunity. I mean, because I ended up in places that I didn't think I'd ever see, you know, like small towns throughout the United States. And it was really kind of a great experience, you know, kind of gave me some empathy for what we so often call the flyover country, you know, but it's
You want to say something about that?
No. Just really kind of, you know, getting a sense of the thirst for the arts out there, you know.
Oh, that it's not just a big city phenomenon.
Exactly. You know, like the people want to come and they want to come and support the arts.
Yes.
They want to. It's funny because, you know, I think we've created this kind of reverential view of Shakespeare, but he's actually quite down and dirty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing audiences sort of realize that.
Oh, were you doing Shakespeare?
We were doing Shakespeare, yes. The acting company tours Shakespeare around the country. And so.
Wow. So the bias that rural America is not interested in Shakespeare.
Yes, exactly. Which was not my experience. You
yeah,
know? They're there. That audience is there. You know,
that's great.
They unfortunately have been sort of told that Shakespeare is sort of, you know,
highfalutin.
Highfalutin,
yeah, right?
So when they're confronted with the fact that, oh, actually Shakespeare likes a dirty joke now, they're sort of like, yes. They're like, oh. But that's nice. And, and so I think that kind of awakened me to the idea.
Yeah,
and
expanded you.
Exactly.
Definitely.
So anyway, so I went on tour for a year, and then I finished that job, and then I just kind of did some freelance directing here and there.
You auditioned, or you called up,
Well, again, a lot, well, at least...
It came to you.
Yeah, yeah, I was lucky, you know, like a lot of...
It's what you thought might happen.
Yeah,
yeah,
a lot of opportunities, you know, I mean, I could have hustled more, you know, I mean, I think we could all hustle more, but I think for me,
You can't.
I mean, because it was hard. I mean, it was just, I find that, like, really challenging. But I was meeting enough people, and I was getting enough, building a network enough that I could, you know, when something came up, people would think about me and get in touch. And so since then, I've been, you know, cobbling together this kind of incoherent career.
Yes.
Of just going from project to project. I've been very lucky in that I've never worked on anything that I didn't like, you know. So, and so that's been a, a blessing, and I've been getting more into teaching and other.
Where do you teach?
Right now, I'm on faculty at Texas Tech University.
And how
Lubbock.
Did that happen?
Well, as someone I knew, you know, they were like.
So what you didn't actually think through happened, that the path revealed itself.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, another lesson for me, you know, I thought graduating the path would be a certain thing, just like I thought a director was a certain thing, just as, you know, and again, the lesson here is that it's not.
All right.
Right? The path is what it is.
What it is.
You know.
And preconceived notions almost never work out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and what you did, it seems to me, is that you put one foot in front of the other as it seemed to you to be the place that foot should go.
Yeah.
That this felt okay, you know, psychology felt okay, medical editing felt okay, you know, okay, a couple of acting classes felt okay, then that didn't feel okay, then directing felt okay, so you followed Jesse, right? Which in my view is the only legitimate path. So even when you were trying not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You were trying to be the director, whoever it was, you know, your version of director.
Yeah.
You were doing it. You were doing it. And it has taken you, apparently, at least to this point, where you wanted to go. You are directing, and you are directing things you like to direct.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Great. Okay, so is this the second time you've been here?
Yes, yes. The first time was How I Learned to Drive.
So you want to tell us how that happened?
The second time or the first time?
The first time. Right? I'm assuming the second time is the result of the first time.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah, right. For sure. The Greg Lemming, who heads the conservatory, you know, I really admire him because he's really committed to encouraging young directors. And so one of the ways he does that, I think, is to sort of reach out to his
network. Hire them.
Exactly. Hire them and just reach out and say, you know, hey, reach out to his network and say, who do you know I'm looking for early career directors who are looking for opportunities? And so it was through that network, through a connection with Roger Danforth at the Drama League, which is an amazing organization in New York City. And Roger wrote me and said, Greg is looking for someone. Do you want to interview? And I said, yes.
Yeah.
And so I met with Greg. He said, I'm thinking about this as a season. I mentioned How I Learned to Drive at that point. And I knew Paula Vogel from Yale. And I adore her. She's been an absolute, absolute incredible influence on my life. And so I said, I love that play. You know, I would love to direct it if the opportunity presented itself. And so Greg came to me a few weeks later and said, would you like to come down to Sarasota and direct it?
This is the opportunity.
Exactly.
It's presenting itself.
The opportunity presented itself,
right.
Exactly. Good. And so I came down, had a really great time. The students were wonderful. The faculty here are just superb. And so, and it was interesting because I came in thinking, you know, not knowing what to expect, but being sort of so impressed by what was going on here, I just like, okay, how can I add to this? You know, how can I contribute to what they're trying to do? And so we did that show. it was a really great experience for me. And Greg said, you know, at some point, you know, love to have you back. And so...
And you said...
Please. Please. And so that point came up here with Junction City, you know, and when Greg wrote me about it, he said, you know, I think this is a good play for you. And I was like, yes, I think this is a good play for you too.
Well, tell us about the play.
Sure. Junction City is a play by Adam Bock, mm-hmm. Who's this really wonderful playwright who writes these strange and kind of, I think they're kind of delicious comedies. And the story is about three women who go into the city for a drunken night of partying, mm-hmm. for a bachelorette party. And the bachelorette party goes wrong when the bride-to-be falls in love with, or has a fling with, a guy she meets in the street. And how that sort of disrupts everyone's life from mm-hmm. there on. And so that's the basic kind of plot. But it's a very theatrical text. There's some poetry in it. There's some music. There's some really wild kind of theatrical gestures that Adam has written into it. And it's, I think, a really delightful play. And, you know, it's funny because the first time I read it, I remember my reaction to it being, you know, in Shakespeare's comedies, there's a whole lot of scholarship that talks about how in Shakespeare's comedies, the structure of them usually involves people leaving the city, going to the woods, and discovering who they really are mm-hmm. in the woods. And the first time I read Drunken City, I thought it's actually the reverse, because here people leave the suburbs, come to the city. And find out who they are. And so, I really started to think about the city as this kind of space for transgression and
Transformation.
And transformation mm-hmm. and discovering oneself, you know. So I kind of went into the project with that sort of point of view, that it was going to be just sort of light, frothy, kind of anti-Shakespearean comedy.
That's how they're advertising it.
which I think is right. It's a great...
It has that.
But what's interesting about it, and I think it's a testament to Adam's brilliance as a playwright, is once we started sort of picking at it and looking at the characters, we started having these really kind of deep conversations, the actors and I, these deep conversations about what was going on in these people's lives, you know, and what Adam was actually sort of capturing, you know, in this play. And it was really kind of deep. It was really profound in terms of, you know, we started talking about, oh, this character has this pattern that she keeps repeating in her life.
Yes.
You know, and is this play about her escaping that pattern?
Or is this fulfilling that pattern.
Exactly, right.
Right.
And we started to say, well, this character also
has a pattern.
And so what we ended up was really kind of having this really complex kind of sense of what these characters were going through, which felt very human, because our traditional sense of narrative requires resolution. You know, like all our stories require a beginning, a middle, an end, and something has to resolve and change.
Right.
And so that happens in this play. But what makes it really nice is there's a sense of like, yes, but have they really changed?
So it's psychologically accurate.
It's psychologically accurate.
Yeah. Because the other would be some kind of forced... that is not what people actually do.
Right.
Exactly. Certainly not without some kind of awareness. And unless I have this wrong, they're not having awareness. She's not having awareness, right?
Or she's having a sort of burgeoning sense of awareness.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And she's doing that thing, which I think, you know... again, this, you'll probably recognize this as well, which is, you know, like that sort of 2 a.m. epiphany about one's life, and then six weeks later, did you actually change anything?
Right.
And so,
that's kind of an interesting thing. The epiphany is not enough,
right,
for the change.
That's right.
And if you can't do the change, then you might as well not have the epiphany, because it's too unpleasant.
I don't know that I agree with that. I think the epiphany still has value, you know.
It just makes you miserable. Are you
kidding? Well, sure, but again, you know, like...
Oh, that's the dark in you.
That's the dark in... Well, I guess that is, yeah.
Sure.
But I think also, you know, again, because, I mean, and maybe it's just the people I know, but I do have those conversations with people, which are just these long, involved conversations. They have these profound insights about what it is that's going on with them. And then like 3 months later, we're having the exact same
conversation. Right. Because insight isn't enough.
Yeah.
That's what I believe anyway.
Yeah.
But so one can see in this play, if one is willing to look, for more than what is readily apparent in the froth.
I think so.
Right? Yeah, it's great. It's great. So I'm sure, I mean, I am certainly intrigued. Hopefully everybody else is.
I hope so.
Yes. So I only have one more question.
Sure.
Unless there's something I didn't ask you that you want to tell me.
No, I think that's no. I think I've enjoyed this conversation a great deal.
Good, so. Me too. Yeah. So my other question is, and it's interesting because usually the way I phrase this question is, having given a life to this work, because as you said, the traditional path is somebody figures it out either in childhood or in elementary school, and then they run it, you know?
Yeah.
But you didn't.
No.
So having given as much time as you have to the work of directing, is there something you would say about it, about how it feels, what it means to you, any of that?
Yes.
Good.
I think that what I would say is, you know, as I said from the outset, you know, I'm a very shy and introverted person, and I think that sometimes I have difficulty connecting with people. But I think that my work as director has given me a way of sort of doing that.
Yes.
You know? And that's been really, really wonderful to feel like a part of humanity, you know, and I think that's been the greatest joy of the journey so far.
That is a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Jesse Jaffe.
Thank you so much.
I will see you opening night.
Oh, please.
When you are not able to be your real self, even if you are not shy or introverted, as Jesse is, you can still feel isolated. Not being known is an isolating experience. So if you're living a life that is a version of yourself, but not the whole you, then probably you too are feeling isolated. Even if you seem to have lots of friends, if you seem to have lots of interactions, those interactions are by definition not completely real, not completely intimate. Jesse was able not only to find a career, a work that works for him, something that he can do, that he loves doing, that he does well, that he gets hired to do, he found a place in which he could be his very own self. And as you hear, that is the greatest gift. As I said in the beginning of the show, the mission of The Lynn Show, what The Lynn Show is about, is making this point that many, too many of us come out of childhood with the idea that something about us is not all right. Something about us brings a consequence which we really don't want and doesn't bring the reaction that we do want. What we all want is to be loved, to be accepted, to be nourished, to be cared for. Unfortunately, so many people get the idea that something about them is not all right, and it brings the consequence of neglect, embarrassment, teasing, ostracization. We hear so much about bullying now from peers, and even trauma, punishment and trauma. Well, children cannot tolerate it. And so first they try and pretend that whatever it is isn't true. I don't do that. I don't like that. I don't think that. And quite often we get good enough at that pretense that we forget. We forget that we could laugh out loud spontaneously. We forget that we were interested in drawing or painting or dancing. We forget that we could stand up for ourselves and say, no, I don't like that, or I don't want that. We forget whatever it was that brought the consequence that we absolutely did not want. And then we are someone who doesn't have access to our whole self. And when you don't have access to your whole self, you cannot have really intimate relationships because part of you is hiding. Part of you is not in it. So the Lin Show is about saying that it is possible to recover, to rediscover those aspects of ourselves which we had to hide. So if you think you are in denial for some aspect of yourself, if you think that you are not being able to be your whole self in your life, if you are doing a work that doesn't fit you, that doesn't feel like you, and you would like to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynshow.com. There's an email tab. Click on that. Ask me any questions that you would like. Up there, you can also listen to all the shows I've ever done, including this one. You can listen to me read the first chapter of my book. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. As always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, preferably, but maybe just something that you enjoyed, as you could hear Jesse and I enjoying. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. Time that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so you won't hear.